All right, so for this deep dive, we're getting into Joanna Macy. And you can almost say she's like the psychological support beam for the entire modern environmental movement.
For sure. Our mission here is really to unpack why they call her a cultural midwife. She literally gave the movement a kind of a survival kit for the mind.
And her own origin story is just so wild, so full of irony.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have this woman born in 1929,
Yeah.
and where does she end up
The
working?
CIA. In Cold War Germany, of all places.
Exactly. So she wasn't just, reading about geopolitics. She was seeing the actual mechanics of global power and this truly insane logic of mutually assured destruction, MAD, up
It's
close.
just, yeah, it's an incredible irony. She sees the whole world operating on this logic of planetary self-destruction.
And then dedicates the rest of her life to creating the antidote. She saw the real threat wasn't just, say, a polluted river. It was omnicide, the death of everything.
And the effect that has on people, that paralysis.
Right. She had a term for it. Psychic numbing. When a problem is that huge, the ego just, it shuts down. It can't cope.
So she needed a foundation, something strong enough to hold all that planetary scale grief.
And that's where her big academic breakthrough happens. Her PhD thesis was this incredible synthesis.
She combines two things that seem worlds apart.
Totally. On one hand, you have early Buddhist teachings, specifically this idea of dependent co-arising.
The idea that nothing exists on its own, everything is interconnected.
Yes. And she merges that with general systems theory, or GST, which is, a very modern scientific way of looking at complex networks.
So, what was the connection she saw?
Well, she saw that the system scientists talking about feedback loops were basically just describing, in scientific terms, the very same interbeing that the Buddha realized 2,500 years ago.
It's the same underlying reality, just with a different vocabulary.
Precisely. And that synthesis gave her work this incredible authority because she could speak the language of science and the language of spirit.
And that led directly to her idea of the greening of the self, right? The ecological self.
Yeah. The big insight there is that the environmental crisis isn't really an out there problem. It's an in here problem. It's a crisis of the egoic self,
Yeah.
this delusion that we're all separate.
Which completely flips the motivation for acting.
Oh, completely. If your self isn't just what's inside your skin, but is the whole web of life that sustains you,
Then protecting the Amazon isn't some noble altruistic
it's
act.
self-defense. I mean, she has that amazing line, "I am the rainforest defending herself."
So that brings us to her practical work, the work that reconnects. How does it actually do that?
The most crucial part of it is this radical reframing of our pain.
Okay. Because our society's message is that anxiety, grief about the world, that's a pathology. It's something to be fixed or distracted from.
Right. She says that pain, that grief, that rage, that fear you feel for the world is not the problem. It is the most authentic evidence of your connection to it. It proves you're paying attention.
So you lean into it.
You honor it. The WTR uses rituals like the Truth Mandala to give that pain a voice. The idea is to transmute all that suppressed grief into energy, into fuel for action.
And that need for action was, for her, really sharpened by the nuclear threat.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, how do you even think about something like nuclear waste? Plutonium-239 has a half-life of 24,000 years.
24,000 years. It's almost an impossible timescale for the human mind.
It forces O to inhabit what she called deep time, to think of ourselves not just as us now, but as ancestors. We have to adopt a guardianship ethic for beings that will exist 10,000 years from now.
So if you're dealing with that scale, what kind of hope can you possibly have? This gets to her idea of active hope.
And it's so important to get the distinction. Passive hope is just. It's a noun. It's sitting back and asking, are we going to be okay? It's just an assessment of the odds.
But active hope is different.
Active hope is a verb. It's a practice. It means you figure out which direction you want to move in and you start moving, regardless of whether you think you'll succeed.
And that brings us to her final, really provocative idea, how she saw our current moment in time.
She saw it as the bardo, which is a Buddhist term for an intermediate state, a terrifying, confusing gap between the old world that's dying, industrial growth society, and a new one that hasn't been born yet.
We're in the gap.
We're in the gap. And the instruction for the bardo isn't to panic, it's to practice what she calls mirror wisdom,
Which means,
which means sustaining the gaze, looking right into the mirror of reality, at the mess, the pain, the uncertainty, and not flinching. accepting it all completely.
And it's from that place of radical clarity.
Exactly. From that clarity, your challenge and the practice of active hope is to find your specific part to play in what she called the great turning.